Halló og velkomin í Algjör Bíó, vikulega hlaðvarpið frá klárasta kvikmyndatímaritinu. Í þessari viku munum við fara í Víking með The Northman, stórmynd sem gerist á Íslandi og byggð á góðsögninni konungssoninn Amlóða. Góða skemmtun.
Hello, I'm not Jane Crowther, who's taken a well-deserved holiday. I'm Jordan Farley, news editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. The voice you just heard wasn't me either. That was our Icelandic production editor, Erlinga Einarsson, welcoming you to this episode in honor of this week's big release, The Northman, which, if you don't know, is mostly set on the beautiful barren rock Erlinga calls home. At least that's what he told us he was saying. Perhaps he was publicly announcing his desire for vengeance because we're always handing in our copy late. We'll never know. Today, I'm joined by our editor at large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
And TF contributor, Leila Latif.
Hi.
This week, we're getting our Viking on with Robert Eggers' The Northman, uncovering the spy business with Operation Mincemeat, exploring the Wimple things with Paul Verhoeven's Benedetta, and getting embroiled in political misdeeds with Netflix Anatomy of a Scandal. But before we get into those, what have you been watching this week, Leila?
I am very deep into tech bro scamming shows at the moment. So all week I've been watching We Crashed, The Dropout, and then this other one, which hasn't come out in England yet, but because I work for some American publications, they sent me, which I think is actually my favorite, called Super Pumped. And they are the rise and fall of WeWork, Theranos, and Uber. And I love them all. Like, I actually struggle to choose between my children so much because I think they're all so fascinating. You know, when I used to like true crime stuff, I always thought it's remarkably easy to start a cult a lot of the time. And in these ones, it seems to be like remarkably easy to get a lot of people to believe in your terrible idea, make billions of dollars, and then sort of like a Greek anti-hero, like crash down because of like the weight of your own like hubris and arrogance. But the Super Pumped one is really, really fun. Quentin Tarantino narrates. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is playing, like, honestly, the most horrendous tech bro imaginable. Like, with the other two, they've got some redeeming qualities. Travis from Uber has none, and it's so much fun.
Wow, that sounds great. I've watched The Dropout as well. I watched the last episode of the weekend, thought Amanda Seyfried, just great in that show. But I'm really enjoying We Crashed. I'm surprised by how much I'm enjoying Jared Leto in that show. I think it's my favorite of his performances in years and years. He's so much fun.
He really is. And I mean, think of like Anne Hathaway's characters, kind of like Gwyneth Paltrow's Tethered. Oh, like it's everything about Gwyneth Paltrow, but like slightly evil.
Exactly. Jamie, what have you been watching?
I've been continuing my nature horror season I've been doing, which is basically awesome. In the 70s, there was a whole cycle of horror films, which were sort of, you know, warning what will happen if you screw around with nature too much, or like ecological kind of themes going on and all of that. So there was Frogs, which is man eating frogs, as you can imagine. I watched Squirm, where an electric pylon in a storm falls on the earth and electrocutes all the worms and turns them into man eating worms. Food of the Gods, Night of the Lepus, which of course is rabbits. And I've been watching all of those, and they're all pretty awful, to be honest. They're really, really bad, but in a kind of fun way. I mean, obviously, if you're looking at sort of nature attacks or nature bites back horror movies, the classic ones are Jaws and Birds, for Birds, Hitchcock. And these are nowhere near in that league. As you can imagine, they're sort of really Z-grade movies. But I just find it really interesting that they were all made at the same time. And, you know, we're talking 50 years ago, and here we are 50 years later, and nothing's changed. We're still talking about how much we're screwing up the planet and we're all going to die. So you would have thought they would have watched Night of the Lepus like 50 years ago and maybe gone, we've got to do something about this, or lots of rabbits are going to eat us.
Incredible. I expect nothing less from you, Jamie. What inspired this season, mini season of films?
Well, basically, as you know, I'm a absolute horror nerd and have watched kind of everything. And I've suddenly realized that I've never seen the film Frogs. And and like, even though it's hardly a classic, you know, it is kind of talked about in fond terms. And it's probably the most famous horror movie I've not seen, even though it's not famous at all, really. But I thought I really should watch Frogs. So I tracked it down and watched Frogs. And then I have this terrible tendency that I just start off on seasons, that when I do one, I have to see everything. So then I thought, you know what, I'm going to go back and watch all of these sort of man-eating ants and worms and God knows what features. So I've just sort of been watching one a night, and it's just a good switch-off entertainment, really.
Just one question. Do they get bigger, or is it just a case of, like, they outnumber you in order to eat you?
It varies film to film. I mean, basically, in Food of the Gods, which is set on an island, they all get bigger. So... Right. I can't actually remember what happens, but something happens. It's something to do with polluting the earth with some chemical, and all the creatures grow bigger. So you suddenly see like a giant wasp buzzing away. And then you see, like, you know, there's a giant rooster in the shed, which is literally the size of a truck or like a minivan or something. So you get ones that are bigger, but you also get ones where it's just a hell of a lot of them. Kingdom of the Spiders, for example, they actually, they bought in 5,000 tarantulas for that film. And they're all normal tarantulas. But as you can imagine, if a town is overrun with 5,000 tarantulas, you're pretty screwed. So it's just lots and lots of scenes of like people on the floor screaming as about like 100 tarantulas crawl over them, which isn't very scary because, as we know, tarantulas are very, very slow and they just sort of go about their business. And you've got these people like fake screaming, but... But it's interesting, and apparently every single tarantula for that production cost $10, so they spent like £50,000 on tarantulas, which was like their whole budget. So you can imagine what the film's like.
Well, I'm so grateful we went down this rabbit hole, because that was very, very entertaining. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.
For myself, as well as We Crashed, I've been watching Severance on Apple TV Plus, the buzzy new Ben Stiller show. I'm a little late to the party because it's actually already finished its 9-episode run. I'm only 4 episodes in, but I'm very much enjoying what I'm seeing so far. Incredible, just off-kilter, sinister atmosphere to the whole thing that I'm really digging, and a great sort of central mystery. What the hell is going on? I need to know. Please don't tell me if you've already seen it, but I'm very excited to watch the rest. It's very, very good.
Well, you know, it won't be resolved because it's been renewed for season 2. So it might be many years before you figure out what's going on.
Cliffhanger time. That's coming up then.
It's a brilliant concept, isn't it? I can't believe anyone hasn't thought of it before. That whole idea of sort of splitting your work and personal life. That the idea for people who haven't seen it is that while you're at work, that's your whole life and it's all you know. And then when the moment you clock out, you kind of, through a medical procedure, surgical procedure, you then become your kind of a home person. So you don't know anything about your work life and you can just give 100% of yourself to family and friends. So on the surface, that sounds like a great idea. Like, who wouldn't want to do that? But obviously it has terrible fault lines to it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Except for in our cases, it would be an absolute nightmare because I don't know when I'm working and when I'm like, when I, you know, you turn off something that, okay, this is technically a screener, and then I'm going to switch on this film that I'm watching. Yeah. I have very blurred lines.
Yeah.
Technically, it's all research, I suppose.
I'm the same. Like when I watch all those animal attack movies, for example, I don't need to watch those at all, but I want to watch them. Because one, it's entertaining, it's my passion, but two, it all feeds into your job. It's background knowledge, isn't it? It's building up the older film knowledge. Just going to jump in with Severance to say I actually interviewed Ben Stiller a couple of months ago for Severance.
And, you did?
I did, for your news section. And they got in touch with me like literally the night before the interview, and they said, right, make sure you watch all of Severance before you interview Ben tomorrow. And they sent me 9-hour-long episodes. So it was like, cheers, guys. So that was my next day. But I tried to watch all 9, but I managed 7 of them in the course of a day. I watched 7 hours. And then I really, really loved it. I was enjoying it so much. But then I did the interview and I've not gone back to it yet, which was 6 weeks ago. So I must finish the last two. But the moment Ben Stiller came on Zoom, he just said to me, like, oh, did you manage to see any of the show? And I said, oh, I'm really sorry, Ben. I've really tried, but only managed to see 7 episodes. Like, they sent it to me last night. I've seen 7. And he couldn't believe I'd seen 7. He was like, oh, man, that is awesome. Thank you so much. He said, like, I didn't even know if you'd managed to see 1. Like, he's like, that's so good of you. Like, for God's sake, he told me to watch all 9. But anyway, yeah. There you go.
I had to do 10 hours of the Underground Railroad on a single day. Ahead of talking to Barry Jenkins, and I don't know if you've seen that show, but that is not heavy an easy going. Day.
Yeah. I think that show is terrific, but I struggled to do more than 1 episode at a time of that show just because it weighed so heavily on the soul, you know.
Yeah. Wouldn't recommend as a binge watch.
Yeah, spread it out. It's a great show, just don't watch it all in one day. Right, so before we look at this week's new releases, if you're a regular listener, you'll have heard our review of The Lost City last week. So when we got the opportunity to sit down with that film's star, Sandra Bullock, well, we certainly didn't tell her to get lost, let's put it that way. So we sent Jack Shepherd for an in-person sit-down with Sandy to talk about her new film, The Lost City, and here's what she had to say.
Miss Sage, I enjoyed your book about The Lost City, and I believe you're the one who can help me find its treasure.
I have to respectfully decline.
I'm afraid I must insist.
Unchain me!
That's your seatbelt.
Oh, no. Loretta Sage is missing.
I'm gonna rescue her. I just want her to think of me as more than a cover model.
Let's start living dangerously.
Alan, what are you doing here?
We're here to save you. I'm certified CPR, I'm certified CrossFit. I have snacks.
Off to them!
Really enjoyed Lost City.
Oh, good.
Would have liked the name to be Lost City of D because I like the joke there.
Yeah, but why not Lost City of V?
Well, there you go.
That's my argument. I go, why does the D get all the attention? And so I figured they removed it because there was just an argument.
I think that's
that they wanted to avoid.
A fair point. I mean, this film, what I most enjoyed was probably the physical comedy about it.
Yeah.
There was one scene in particular where you kind of go all rigid and it's like you're like lying in a hammock with Channing.
Oh, during the hammock scene?
Yeah.
No one writes like that unless you beg them. Okay. You know, you're like, okay, this is the scene. They're camping out. And we're like, the camping is so boring. What are they camping in? How can we make for moments like that where you put people in an awkward situation and they need to physically distance themselves while they can't be distanced?
Mm.
So it just, it's guilty pleasure.
How do you get to a level where you're kind of comfortable with another actor, with a co-star doing that kind of stuff? Because I feel like you need to be quite vulnerable in a situation like that. So how do you get to that kind of level?
That's a really great question. Really make sure you know who your co-star is and their comfort level. Mm. I react off of other people's comfort levels. So if there's sort of a rigidity to them, I become very rigid and I change my physicality. Channing is very loose. He and I are very similar in how much we enjoy using our bodies to get a point across rather than words. So there was a comfort level right off. That's not true. There is the cursory, oh, okay, now my body is on top of yours and yours is on top of mine. We are not in a relationship. How do you make that comfortable? But the minute he and I both understood each other physically, we knew how we could make a joke better together rather than trying to chew up scenery as an actor by ourselves, which is what we do most of the time. You're like, look at me. So we were better in tandem, I felt, than we were apart.
How do you know that you're going to have that with another actor, though? Because surely, I know it's like great casting that the two of you kind of come together, but, you know, it could have gone, you could have been cast with someone who...
You hate just, it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So how do you work that out and realize, like, this is going to work?
I don't know. A lot of it is luck. A lot of it is intuition. A lot of it is, there's lots here, is being in a position where I don't have to work with someone that I am not super comfortable with. Yeah, albeit sometimes, you know, we all give good meeting and then you have, you know, 2 months into it, you hate each other. I'm sure that happens, but, and you have bumps. No matter who you're working with, you're going to have relationship bumps. You're going to have to get over something which either brings you closer or pulls you farther apart. But I'm in a really privileged position where I choose not to work with assholes anymore. And you do your research. I knew Channing from a school situation. We knew each other socially. They came over for Easter parties with kids and stuff. But you don't really know each other. We're on our best behavior. So I asked a lot of people who had worked with him, like, what is he really like when he's not on his best behavior. Yeah. And the blanket comments that came back were all exactly the same. There wasn't two that were similar and then three had a different experience. That's when you start questioning, you know, not at all. And so you just have to do your research. But again, I'm in a really privileged position that I don't have to work with people that are going to make life miserable.
Mm. Do you think that comes from being a, because you're a producer on this film as well. So
for sure.
I guess that adds like a different level to how much you can kind of control what's happening. And
yeah. Quality control, for sure. Mm. You know, story control, yes. Finances, yes. You can say no a lot and yeah. be comfortable in that position rather than saying no with a question mark. Like, no, I don't like. And that's a hard place for a lot of people, especially actors. Unless you're a mega superstar and people give you whatever you want, you're pretty much in your trailer until they call you out. And then you should just feel grateful to be there.
Yeah.
So yes, being in the producerial role, which I love, allows you to pick and choose your experience to a certain degree. I choose working with people who are crazy talented, but also kind.
Yeah. And Channing seems to tick all those boxes. I love both your on-screen chemistry and also the kind of off-screen stuff. It seems like you've had
It's just stupidity. It's just stupidity. Yeah. It's just our humor in real life is the lowest common denominator and we find it hysterical. And I'm like, thank God there's someone like that next to you that isn't rolling their eyes and judging and commenting because he's at the bottom of the barrel right with me.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. I mean, I was reading that apparently there was, I mean, not only did you have like the COVID procedures, but also there was a stomach bug.
Or epidemic, yes. Yeah. I've learned the differences between pandemic and epidemic. Yes, there was a parasite that was making its way through almost everyone. And then there was severe dehydration, which you don't realize is happening until something starts going seriously wrong, like your kidneys shut down. We had people in the hospital on a daily basis and it was crazy. But for some reason we were like, we're going to be fine because none of us were falling over from COVID. So COVID was the bar and then everything underneath it we thought was manageable, which is actually stupidity in hindsight because everything else that was happening was just as bad. Mm. It just didn't land in the pandemic category, so we didn't look at it as bad.
I find that so funny. Like on a normal set, any other time, that would have been like, no, we're going to
the parasite would have shut us down. Yep. The dehydration would have shut us down. Like we had issues with food. Like it was just everything, but we were so grateful and happy to be in this beautiful place and not locked in our homes that we were fine. We just had a whole new perspective having been locked away for a year and a half.
I mean, it's amazing that you can kind of have that going on behind the scenes, but also create something so joyous and like proper escapism which this film is. And I think, you know, you've just had like a really good box office start in the US as well. Mm-hmm. And it feels like it just shows that people are after this kind of movie. You know, it's not just the Marvels and the Batmans and stuff like that, but it is this like fun kind of comedy. Like what's your takeaway been from all this?
You know, we've been asking ourselves, would this film have been received the way it's being received now before the pandemic? I don't think so. Okay. I don't think there would have been an open heart to it. It'd be looked at as much needed escapism. We landed at a time that it seems people really want to just have a ride. I mean, my son was on, you know, talking to his friend and he says, yeah, our whole class is going to see your mom's movie. I went, what? Wait, you're in the sixth grade. Is that appropriate? Do I need to sit down and explain to them a couple of the scenes?
Yeah.
But it's turning out to be something that mothers and families are feeling okay taking their kids to because everybody can laugh.
Yeah.
That feels good.
It was interesting reading in a recent interview because you said that rom-coms were kind of like undervalued and fell out of favor. Is it primed for a comeback? And do you think that comeback will be on the big screen or kind of streaming?
Both.
Okay.
I mean, I'm one of those that believes that streaming and big screen have equal footing and a valuable place in both sides. I don't think it's one or the other. I love them both. Rom-coms, if you go back to the 30s and 40s, they were exquisite. They had scope. They had brilliant writers because it all hinged on two people, oil and vinegar, with rapid fire dialogue, incredibly smart, on a journey somewhere to a destination, to a place. It might have been in a gorgeous house. It might have been in a dilapidated house. But the set, everything was curated and a feast for the eyes. What happened was action films. And then all of a sudden, the rom-coms were, oh, it's a chick flick. And I go, why are you saying that with stink face? Like, it just felt so disparaging.
Yeah.
That being funny, being romantic was a negative. Mm. We all got very cynical. Comedy needs to get better. Subject matter needs to get deeper. I hope rom-com has a place to stay, but with a new facelift where it has value and it has depth and it has something you want to go see in the theater. Mm. Otherwise, streaming is brilliant for something that takes place in one room or in a smaller space where you can have the privacy to immerse yourself in whatever that journey is.
A comedy actor is kind of like never up for an Oscar. And I mean, you yourself, you obviously have the Oscar and you've done a lot of comedy. Do you think comedy needs to be recognized in those spaces more? You know, someone like Channing in this is brilliant.
Yeah.
But I would say he's probably not.
Yeah, we're not winning any Oscars.
That feels like a shame, surely.
I don't put a lot of self-importance on it, but I take my job incredibly seriously. I don't let go easily. I am there till the last. We were working on this film until 3 weeks ago, you know? I mean, I still have to record a line. You know, it's... I don't stop until I'm told I can't do anything else. Mm. But I also don't go on the journeys to hopefully sit in a seat and have everyone go, oh my God, you're so brilliant. Yeah. It would be nice if that happened every single day. It's just not.
And do you want to record the line now with the microphone?
I know. Or? It's like I have to replace the line mountains, the mountains of Afghanistan. And I literally have my little microphone with me upstairs. So at some point, I have to tweak the line.
Yeah, okay.
But that's just the fun part of technology now you know, before you'd have to go into an entire soundstage. COVID, your house turned into a soundstage. It's amazing what you can stick on your closet wall to create the ultimate recording studio. My daughter's closet was the best sound for all the recording ADR that was done in this film that wasn't captured live was done in an 8-year-old's closet.
Straight to you from a closet. Yes, that's so funny.
Yes, interesting tidbit.
In this movie, I again was reading about you were doing a whole lot of like ad-libbing, especially Channing. Apparently you were kind of like laughing quite a lot. So
there were some
takes that were unusable.
Yes. Well, I mean, we use them in the outtakes, like in the, you know, the nice bloopers. Thing about the blooper reel is just, I could not hold it together because anytime he was behind me, I forget it. If he was saying something, if I couldn't see his face, I would lose it. There's a scene at the opening of the film where we're on these chairs and I said, make the chairs really high and don't give me a place to put my feet so it's uncomfortable. And so once I got settled, I go, okay, you know, I'm going to be fine. And then Channing would just start ad-libbing and I would turn away from him a little bit more. And then I realized if I can't see him, I laugh more. So I was like, maybe turn into him. And then know when he looks at me, I laugh more. It's not a pleasant problem to have when you're also the producer and you know you're wasting valuable time. But I just love being around Channing and the fact that he can make me laugh. And he goes, I need to figure out what the formula is to make you laugh. And I go, dude, you won't because I don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
Just let's enjoy it. Let's enjoy that we're actually laughing and not crying.
It sounds like a really fun set to be on. I mean, one of the funniest scenes is obviously, and I feel like you've been asked a million times about it, is the leeches on the bum scene.
Yes.
I mean, is there a question or a story you haven't told about that scene yet? Or is it all, it's all been played?
I mean, I look back on that day, my knees were killing me. I was on rock. I was on rock and it hurt with the sequence digging into my knees and everyone was worried about Channing's bum. And I was like, he's not on his knees. No one thinks about the woman on her knees, do they? It was a logistical nightmare because of the humidity, the way that the leeches were stuck to his body. If I pulled it off, it required a reset and then we had to wait there. I'm on my knees with the leeches being stuck back on. The glue was getting humid. Then they were leaving a mark and we went, should we wipe it off now and cover it up so we don't have to pay for it in post? So your producer hat goes on going, how much will it cost to erase the glue? Can we just do it? And then we'll erase it in post. And someone would say, well, that's about $1,200. That's $5,000. I'm like, just do it. Just do it. You know, it's those are the things that are happening that day.
Oh, man.
That's what I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I remember the directors throwing out their ad-libs, just the things that they were having me say. they were getting longer and longer and longer. And it was an insane day. And what you remember of it is just a fraction of what was actually going down. You know, Channing was the one that had cheeks to the wind and everything else to the wind. So you'd have to ask him about what that was like for him.
So The Lost City is in cinemas right now. Okay, it's time to talk vengeance with this.
I will avenge you, Father! I will save you, Mother! I will kill you, Fiona!
I will avenge you, Father. I will save you, Mother. I will kill you, Fiona.
Why would he stow away to such a hellish place?
To find what was stolen from me.
And what is that?
The kingdom.
That's The Northman. Jamie, you want to set this one up?
Yeah, so the story is very, very basic, really. But it's about a young Viking prince called Amleth, who, when we meet him, he's only a boy. He's probably like 9 or 10 years old. And his father, the king, played by Ethan Hawke, returns from battle and everything's great for a few minutes. And then this young prince sees his father, the king, murdered by his uncle, the king's brother, right in front of his eyes. And he sees him murdered. And the queen, played by Nicole Kidman, is kind of thrown over the uncle's shoulders. The uncle claims her for himself and he strides off with her and he usurps the crown. So the young prince manages to escape because they want to kill him as well. And he swears a pledge of vengeance. He says, you know, I will return. I'll take my vengeance for my mother and my father. And then we cut to many years later, an elite Viking warrior, a berserker, played by Alexander Skarsgård, who is the size of a tank in this film. If you thought he was big in Tarzan, he's really ripped. And he's an elite warrior. And for a while, he's going around doing his Viking stuff, various raids, sword fights, etc. And then he remembers his pledge and he sort of gets back on track and he thinks, right, I'm going to get revenge. And the rest of the film is him going after his uncle to avenge his father. Now, if that story rings a big bell, that's because it did, of course, influence William Shakespeare massively for Hamlet. He pretty much ripped it off. So, it's the story of Amleth. It's like an Icelandic saga, which I think has been around since about the 10th century. It was written down in the 13th century. And Robert Eggers has chosen this story to turn it into his third feature film.
We've given this film 5 stars. It's been getting rave reviews across the board, pretty much. Layla, do you agree with those reviews?
Oh, yeah. 5 stars, 10 stars, 10,000 stars. No notes. Perfect film. 5 stars for the naked lava fight alone. I think when I read Jamie's feature, that might be the second sentence that, like, one of the things that they knew that they had to do is to have two naked men fighting in a volcano. It's a beautiful thing to behold. Place Bang has clearly also gotten ripped. I don't want to give away too much. So it's a really familiar story, right? And, you know, we've seen it with, you know, all of these Hamlet productions. It's the basic beats of The Lion King. But I remember watching it, knowing what it was going to kind of bare bones be. But we kind of get essentially to the point where Simba is returning to the Pride Land by about the half hour mark. So I was just like, so what the hell is the rest of this film going to be? Because this could be over in 10 minutes theory. And it's such like a wild exploration of like imagination and like really exploring the landscape and spectacular violence, and it's romantic and it's sexy. And I loved it.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. I absolutely love this as well. For me, Robert Eggers hasn't missed at this point. The Witch and The Lighthouse are both modern classics as far as I'm concerned. And this is another to add to those ranks. The thing that I really love that he does so well, but, you know, I don't even think I've seen this in a Viking saga before, is he just deals in sort of myth making and folklore in such a compelling and fascinating way. There's this whole sort of supernatural sort of element to this film, which you can sort of read as being within the heads of the characters. You know, they're characters who believe in Valhalla and the outer gods and things like this. So there's nothing sort of concrete where they go, you know, there's a dragon flying across the screen or something like that, but there are very sort of off-kilter strange moments. There are hallucinatory sequences. One of the first sequences near the start of the film is this incredible hallucinatory kind of rite of passage that the young Amleth goes through with Ethan Hawke and Willem Dafoe, and it's just so like primal and weird and full of all this strange imagery. And I just couldn't believe that I was watching this in a sort of you know, nearly $100 million kind of wide release Universal film. It is quite incredible to me that someone had bankrolled a film just this weird. But I absolutely love that side of it, as well as the action berserker side. There's a terrific, terrific set piece. Very near the beginning of Amleth's adult journey, where they raid this small town, and it's done in effectively what looks like one take, and it's just breathtaking. The cinematography, like the choreography, Skarsgård's performance in those scenes, he's just so fearsome, they're so ferocious. I was just completely absorbed from start to finish. I was absolutely blown away, perhaps even more so than his first two films, which, as I mentioned, I absolutely love, especially The Lighthouse, which Jamie and I were lucky enough to see at his first press screening at Cannes. And I remember just being absolutely like bowled over by it. But I had a very similar experience coming out of this one, where I just couldn't believe that a film like this even exists, let alone that it's as good as it is.
I'm exactly the same, Jordan, that what stunned me was that this film cost $90 million to make, and you'd think that he would have to really, really sort of go a bit mainstream, and he hasn't at all. That even the battle scenes where you think, okay, this is going to be the mainstream stuff, there's lots of sort of big epic battles, but even them, he filmed them all with one camera. So we're used to sort of Michael Bay cutting and 24 cameras, and he filmed them all with one camera. So you've got like 4 minute, 5 minute sequences all shot in one take, where the camera's just roaming around and it's choreographed to perfection, but not in a glossy way. It's all mud and blood and it's brutality, and it's just absolutely staggering. And the other thing he does, of course, which he's done in all his films, Robert Eggers, is he immerses his characters in a real world. So he filmed it all in Ireland and in Iceland, up the side of mountains and gale force winds, torrential rain. And it's very beautiful landscapes as well, but you really feel that desolation, the kind of rugged nature. It infects the entire movie. It pervades all the performances. It's just staggering. You know, they say Hollywood doesn't make films like this anymore, and they don't, but it's all CGI, and, you know, and they don't go off and do Apocalypse Now anymore in the jungle. But this is as near as we've seen for a long time. And the flights of imagination, it's so weird. You know, only Robert Eggers could have made it. And it's just really, really bold filmmaking. And I just pray to God that people go and see it and it does well at the box office, because if it doesn't, then we won't see a film like this again.
Yeah, even like thought. I love the female characters in this so much, and I think that's something that has often been like really underserved in a lot of adaptations of Hamlet. And there was a moment about the kind of halfway mark where I was just like, I wonder why Nicole Kidman's in this, because is it just because, you know, then you can get her out to like a load of talk shows to promote this and stuff, and then something happens and you're just like, no, this is full unhinged Nicole Kidman from To Die For, from, you know, real acting chops. And I think I think Nicole Kidman is an incredible actress, and she's got a scene in this that I think was just absolutely floored me. I've seen this film 3 times now. Their PR team must be very sick of me. I've gone twice begging and then once as someone's plus one. Absolutely brilliant. I just feel like the Green Knight walked so the Northman could run.
Yeah, I think you're right. Layla, you and I were both at the UK premiere of this film, and that Nicole Kidman moment, it reminded me, you know, those kind of viral videos of like Captain America catching the hammer in Endgame and the crowd just kind of goes nuts. That Nicole Kidman moment had like a kind of inverse evil version of that scene, like that moment within the audience at the UK premiere, just the reaction to it was
oh no.
Everyone just recoiled in horror in a way like I don't think I've ever experienced in a cinema before. It's quite incredible. But yeah, you're absolutely right. She's terrific. Anya Taylor-Joy, also terrific in this film. It's quite a significant presence throughout the film, actually. She meets Amleth very early and is there for the rest of the journey. And she's a very interesting character in this, because she makes it clear from the start that Amleth is there to, you know, break men's bodies and she's there to break men's minds. And I thought that was really fascinating that she brings the sort of psychological aspect to this whole war of terror that they kind of rage on Fjolnir throughout the bulk of this film. What did you think of their sort of dynamic together?
I thought they were great. And like you said, Anya Taylor-Joy, she plays Olga of the Birch Forest, which is such a great name for a character. I just love the fact she's such a strange character, but she's quite witchy and in a Wiccan way, that she's linked to the earth and to nature, and it all kind of flows through her and the powers. And yeah, she's absolutely great. I mean, Robert Eggers was the one who kind of discovered her and gave her a break in The Witch. And here she is again. And she's had such a career since. She's absolutely terrific. And now obviously a superstar after The Queen's Gambit and everything. But what I love about Anya Taylor-Joy is she always throws herself into things 100%. You know, there's no ego or anything. So she's up in the mud and blood as much as anyone else. And yeah, it's just really fascinating. This film works on every level, psychological, it's visceral, the violence, absolutely great. And I also loved it. You mentioned earlier I did the feature, and talking to Robert Eggers, you kind of expect, I asked that age-old question you have to ask about the battle scenes and like, did you have any influences? And you kind of half expect, everyone always says stuff like Braveheart or Lord of the Rings. And he was like, oh yeah, you know, Andrei Rublev by Andrei Tarkovsky. And when he started mentioning Kurosawa and stuff like that. And, you know, that's the kind of realm we're in. It will appeal to mainstream audiences as well, because it's such a brutal, spectacular, big film. But he does, he sort of straddles those two worlds superbly.
Yeah, my dad's desperate to see this film. He keeps asking me about when it's coming out, and I keep telling him it's coming out on Friday. He's just so desperate. So I hope it is going to find an audience, because it feels like there is a certain amount of interest surrounding it just because of the reviews and because of the marketing blitz that's taking place at the moment. Do you think it has the potential to be a hit, Layla?
I think so, because I think it will. It kind of works as an action film so well, and it kind of works as a sort of pretentious art house film so well. Like, when does that ever happen? How much did you guys love that there's just like a really brutal game of lacrosse halfway through? And like, and it's one of the most exciting things I've ever seen. And it's weird that in the world where we're now used to all these superheroes and all this like giant action and stuff, the two most exciting things that I've seen this year, that game of lacrosse and that scene in Licorice Pizza where the car is going downhill. Like, it really like reframes what is like properly exciting. Get away from green screen. It's nice stakes, gravities and sticks. That's all you need.
Yeah, Michael Bay can blow up however many ambulances he wants to. The most exciting thing is, yeah, a stick and a ball and a really gruff guy who looks like he's been eating a lot of eggs, you know? That scene as well has one of the coolest moments I think I've seen in a film in a long time as well, where he kind of blocks a hit without even looking. And I just thought, oh man, that is sort of the epitome of cool on screen right there. That was a moment where I was like, oh man, I wish I was Alexander Skarsgård. He's one cool dude.
And also that bit, which I think is in the trailer, when he's going in for a raid and someone chucks a like javelin, a spear at him.
Yeah.
And he just plucks it out the air as it goes whistling by and just turns around and throws it straight back with twice the venom. It's just magnificent. That is a moment the whole audience, men and women, just go weak at the knees. It's wonderful.
It's a real transformation for him as well, isn't it? I mean, as you mentioned, Jamie, we've seen him physically transform for a role like Tarzan before, but this just felt like a whole sort of mental and physical transformation for me. It's a total just primal overhaul of his whole being. I thought I was absolutely blown away by what he's doing here. He's spoken about how he's wanted to make a Viking film since he was a kid, and a lot of the conversations about this film emerged from that at the beginning, and you can understand why this lifelong dedication was there, because he's just so perfect for this film. He's just the prototypical Viking. He's just, yeah, they couldn't have cast a better Amleth, I don't think.
It's really funny as well that he went straight from Succession season 3 to this. And he was literally like, you know, at that amazing pad he's at in Succession, where it's like he's a multi-billionaire tech giant and he's got yachts and everyone kind of bowing to his every need. And he went from that world to 2 days later, he was in Iceland being dragged through mud, you know, half naked. And yeah, it must have been a bit of a shock to the system. But like you said, it's such a committed, full-blooded performance. I mean, he just goes for it full on.
Really feels like no other person on this planet could have played that role.
No, he was born to do it, quite clearly. Okay, so I think we are all in agreement that this is a nailed on 5-star, dare I say the word, masterpiece. It's an absolute banger, if not quite a masterpiece, but I absolutely loved it. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely loved it. Definitely going to be in my top 10 at the end of the year, possibly the top 5, we'll see. See when that David Lynch film is really coming out. Like, give it some competition. Like, yeah, brilliant film.
I think it's definitely 5 stars, and whether it's a masterpiece or not, I think time will tell. And I know Layla's seen it 3 times already. I've seen it once, and I need to see it a couple more times. I think the M word is a big word, but it's if it's not a masterpiece, it's pretty damn close.
Okay, so The Northman hits cinemas this Friday. Hop on your nearest Valkyrie and ride to your nearest gates of Valhalla.
To hear more about The Northman, you can download the new episode of our Last Picture Show podcast series, which features the film's director, Robert Eggers, discussing the making of his Viking epic and which 4 films he would watch on the last day on Earth. That's available from all good podcast providers from this Friday.
From Valhalla to World War II, now it's this.
In 5 weeks, 100,000 British forces will strike Sicily's southern shore.
Unfortunately, the Nazis know of our intentions. So we're going to play a humiliating trick on Hitler.
We have to convince Germany that our target is Greece.
The plan begins in Spain, where a corpse will wash up on shore bearing classified letters.
A corpse carrying fake documents.
Layla, tell us about Operation Mincemeat.
So Operation Mincemeat was the codename for this rather ridiculous British military operation during World War II. And so the Allied forces were planning to invade Sicily, but they wanted the Germans to think that they were going to invade Greece. So they kind of came up with a Weekend at Bernie style plan of, we're going to put some fake documents on a body, kind of get him to wash up to shore and try and convince them that this was actually a real British soldier who has like the secret plans of them to invade Greece. And yeah, it's the latest from John Madden, who's probably best known for Shakespeare in Love and the best exotic Marigold movies. But probably most importantly, it stars 2 Mr. Darcys. Both Colin Firth and Matthew McFadden as like the British intelligence officers. We've got Simon Russell Beale, probably, you know, master of the stage, is our Churchill. And yeah, it's oh God, I don't even know what to say about it. Because I'm so biased when I come to stuff like this, because I am so to my bones sick of World War II. It's like all I studied in history class. That seemed to be the only thing that they ever wanted to teach us about when I was a teenager. I think the last 2 times I've come on this podcast, there's been a World War II film. This one is a perfectly good one. But like when you see kind of a big breath of fresh air, like The Northman, like they come back to this is a bit like, I just feel like I'm kind of done with the story. Could we go to something else? Maybe something about Waterloo. I think there was a 100-year war at one point. Maybe something about that. Like, you know, I feel like there's more to mine from in history than just going on with these, like, World War II again. So honestly, now, if it's not like a masterpiece or borderline masterpiece, like, you know, Dunkirk, and like somebody's who like really exploring the potential of filmmaking with a World War II film, it just like does very little for me.
I don't disagree with that. World War II is a little bit played out on screen. We've seen it from almost every angle at this point. But I have to say, I did enjoy this. What I did like is the fact that it is coming at it from a slightly different perspective, you know, the intelligence agencies rather than the boots on the ground, if you will. It's also kind of a stealth Bond film in a way, which is very weird to say, because Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond, is a character in this film. Played by Johnny Flynn, he had an integral role in dreaming up this Operation Mincemeat plan. And you get moments where they go to a real-life Q branch and Ian Fleming picks up a watch with like a buzzsaw around it. So it's, you can sort of see the sparks of the creation of Bond in this film as well. It's very bizarre. Feels maybe a tiny bit cynical. I know that Fleming, you know, it's a matter of historical record that he was very closely involved with this plan, but he only appears in these key moments where he's basically having a, this could be a great spy story idea. It's not like he's there throughout the entire film. That was a very bizarre, but sort of quite fun idea. Jamie, what did you think?
I kind of agree with Layla that I think it's perfectly fine. It's one of those films where, you know, it's kind of handsome to look at and it's sort of well made in a very middle brow kind of academy friendly sort of way. I agree with you, Jordan, that it's nice to come at it from that different angle, but it's, I think they describe it as a battleground in shades of grey rather than kind of on the in the actual you know, in the air and boots on the ground. It is all played out in interiors and kind of putting your minds together and trying to come up with schemes. But it did just feel a little bit kind of middle of the road to me. But I think John Madden, you know, he's made films like the ones Layla mentioned earlier and Captain Corelli's Mandolin and Mrs. Brown. And you kind of know what you're going to get, that he's a good, solid, decent craftsman filmmaker, but it's just missing that bit of vitality or something in it, a bit of humour, something to kind of spark it alive. But for me, it just sort of plods along a little bit. Interesting, just to go off on a tangent here, what you were saying about being sick to death of World War II, to go back to the Northmen, the screening I went to, History Scholars there, because they're obviously trying to get out that angle as well. And I talked to a couple beforehand, and they told me that over 50% of history books ever written, ever published, are about World War II. So more than the rest of history put together. And then, interestingly, the second most popular area in history in terms of people going online, clicking on links, is Vikings. So it's World War II followed by Vikings. So we are having a classic history week on our pod this week.
Fascinating. Yeah. Ben McIntyre, the author of Operation Mincemeat, the book that this film is based on, he actually came to my uni and delivered a seminar on some book that he'd written before that called Agent Zigzag. So I was sort of vaguely aware of this story in advance. I don't know if either of you have read that book, but I did read it while I was at university. I just found his account of it just so much more entertaining in a way, just because you don't have this sheen of fiction over it as well. The thing that I really didn't like was this, they sort of insert this love triangle between Colin Firth's character, Matthew McFadden's character, and Kelly MacDonald's character. And there's kind of this, just to create some kind of conflict and drama when they're not just coming up with this cockamamie scheme to try and fool the Nazis. And I just felt it was completely unnecessary, to be honest. You've got one of the wildest sort of schemes in all of war history. You just don't need to insert a kind of love triangle drama into the middle of it. Like that felt very much unnecessary to what they were doing here. But I sort of appreciated the attempts at historical accuracy beyond that. You know, a lot of the stuff here is grounded and does come from that book, which is based in rock solid historical research. So at least they tried to do that much.
Yeah, but then I just felt that then that's a bit boring, because I went to go see the Sam Mendes play a couple of years back, like pre-lockdown, which was starring Simon Russell Beale, about like the Lehman Brothers trilogy. And he plays about 14 different characters in it. Convincingly, everything from like dying old men to like six-year-old girls, incredibly. And I'm like, and then when you kind of see this and you just think, well, this is a real boxing in of some talent.
It does to me. I read a review of it. I think it was for Variety. And for me, they hit the nail on the head that they said, if you look at the plot with the idea of, you know, that corpse washing up on the coast of Spain, it sounds like something in an Ealing comedy. And yet they play it as completely straight laced drama. And that for me may be sort of a problem, that I'm not saying go all the way and make it into a comedy, but it does feel it needs a little bit more kind of wit and fun about it. But it is very, very plodding and serious.
Okay, so that's Operation Mincemeat, which hits cinemas this Friday in the UK, and for our American listeners, hits Netflix next month. Right, now it's time for alternative line reading, which regular listeners will know means I have to say a line from a movie in a misleading accent in an attempt to throw Jamie and Layla off the scent. And this week, I'm going to say it in the style of Stitch from Lilo and Stitch, just because it's a voice that I can do. And I think it will be very distracting for you.
I do not want to taunt. I do not want to taunt. Is this not why they're wrestling?
I'm not even sure I made out a word you said there. All I heard was...
That is the key to a good Stitch voice, is just gibberish, basically, and a growl at the end, and then you've nailed it.
Okay.
Any guesses? Do you need me to go again? Please don't tell me you need me to go again.
Well, it's Gladiator, but I'm actually cannot remember whether it's, does Joaquin Phoenix say it or does Russell Crowe say it?
Oh, yeah.
I remember it from the trailer.
That's okay. Maximus, one of his most famous lines, of course. Well done, Layla. Well done. You saw through my ruse and you've hit on the truth.
Well, it's probably because I was DMing Jane Crowther the other day and she was saying that she thought the Northman was this generation's Gladiator. So I had it on the mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a quote I've seen. Yeah, that is literally on the poster. I've seen it on the side of buses. Yeah, This Generation Gladiator, total film.
I saw that on the IMDb homepage the other day. They had a big Northman ad up, and it was the top quote was that.
Well, yeah, they must be happy with that quote then. Okay, well, this is what that line sounds like anyway.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?
Okay, time to get thee to a nunnery.
Benedetta! Viens à moi!
J'arrive, Seigneur! J'arrive!
On ne comprend pas toujours les instruments de Dieu.
Jamie, Paul Verhoeven's back. What's this one about?
So Benedetta is a new film by Paul Verhoeven, the Dutch master, the provocateur behind such classics as Showgirls. And,
that's so unkind as the one to start with.
I do actually like his films a lot. I do. He made RoboCop, of course, the Starship Troopers, both of which are wonderful. Love them both. Total Recall. So anyway, it's his new movie and it's set in the 17th century in a nunnery, and it's about Benedetta, as you may guess from the title, who is played by Virginie Efira. And she joins this nunnery and she claims to have visions of Jesus. She gets stigmata, and she has a kind of hotline to God in a way. So she becomes very important in this nunnery. The Mother Superior, played by Charlotte Rampling, is a bit suspicious whether she's faking it, but she sees the political opportunities as well, that it would get her kind of convent on the map, as it were, that they've got this woman having these visions. And a novice nun called Bartolomea comes. This is a very disturbed young woman, and Benedetta basically takes her under her wing and is going to kind of show her the ropes in a way, and they end up having a very, very passionate lesbian affair, which, as you can imagine, in the 17th century in a nunnery is rather shocking. And in typical Paul Verhoeven style, there's quite a bit of sex, sort of softcore porn going on in there. I was disappointed with it, but I do like his films a lot. I love the fact that he ruffles feathers and he sort of gets everyone up in arms. But this film, for me, very much fell between two stools. It was never quite camp or salacious or trashy enough to work as that kind of film, as a sort of camp masterpiece. And on the other hand, it was never quite serious enough as a period drama to work as a, you know, proper film, in a way, to put it politely. It's based on a book, a 1986 book by Judith Brown called Immodest Acts, The Life of a Lesbian Nun in Renaissance Italy, which the book has a lot of interesting things to say about, you know, about sexuality and being gay in that time. And Verhoeven, for me, kind of hides behind this book, but he always says in interviews, no, this is, you know, it's based on a proper book and this really happened in history and it's a serious subject matter. But I think he was just kind of turned on by what he could do with this film. And it's like a typical Paul Verhoeven movie, and he can sort of poke a few people and, you know, cause a bit of controversy. But like I said, I don't think he goes quite far enough, and it's not witty enough or trashy enough or just out there enough. If you consider this film, I mean, it has burnings at the stakes. It has comets in the skies. There's a plague raging outside. And it sounds like it could be so big and mad and bad and such a crazy movie. But I was rather disappointed by it.
Yeah, I felt like I could sense Verhoeven like sniggering behind the camera throughout the whole film, just thinking, oh, this is going to rile people up. They're going to hate this the whole way through, which I sort of love. He's an 83-year-old man, one of our greatest directors, hasn't made a film in 6 years at this point. I sort of love that he's come back with this, something so provocative, something so controversial, something so sort of cheeky and arch. But I pretty much totally agree with what you're saying there, Jamie. I just almost think he doesn't push it far enough at times. Like he's almost got a bit of kind of the playground kind of antics to him about it in this. I don't think he does anything so wildly controversial that people will be genuinely upset by it. It just feels like he's gently sort of prodding at you and going, oh, look at this. Can you believe that I'm putting this in a film and I'm getting away with it? It felt like a tiny bit immature, which is a funny thing to say about a man, you know, his age. But on the other hand, I am glad that people are funding his films, that he's getting films made, that he's getting films made that are kind of at least attempting to do something a bit controversial, even if I didn't think it was entirely successful. What did you think, Layla?
I think I liked it a bit better than both of you, to be honest. I do agree that it's like imperfect, and at times you can kind of, you know, this film was like protested by Catholics outside of like, I think the New York Film Festival. And it just felt like, oh, I bet he loved that. I bet he was sitting at home just being like, yes, I did it. But yeah, I found it really interesting. I like how it never really settled on what exactly Benedetta's goals are. Like, does she kind of sincerely believe all of this stuff? What is the source of her stigmata? Is this all kind of a power hungry play? You know, just in order to kind of usurp some of the kind of patriarchal constructs that she's like fighting in against. Is she even really in love with Bartolomeo and stuff like that? I love when you have like an ambiguous person at the center that kind of like kept guessing as to what she wanted. And by the end, when the sort of way it concludes, which I believe is entirely historically accurate, like I was surprised again. But yeah, I felt that I just wanted the film to be centered more on Bartolomea, her experience of this, which I thought was kind of much more interesting, and then kind of reacting to it, because there is something a bit with like so much kind of ambiguity and then just into sex scene, and like you just feel like, this is a bit baggy, this is a bit messy, but I still really enjoyed it.
And a film where Charlotte Rampling's performing in French and doing so wonderfully. She's done it in the past, of course, but it always blows me away when I see an actor, you know, speaking in not their native language and performing just as well as they do in English. I can't speak any other languages, so I'm just always blown away by that.
Yeah, Dan Stevens in I'm Your Man sort of went from being like, oh, that's the guy from Downton Abbey, to like, this is one of our great actors. Look, German.
He can do it all. We should say as well that this is a film that's set in Italy and they are speaking in French, which I did find a little bit distracting initially, because I wasn't totally sure why they were filming it in the French language when it was a story set historically in Italy. I understand it was something to do with financing and where it was funding and filmed and then the cast involved. But at the same time, has he essentially done like a House of Gucci here, where he's got people speaking in completely the wrong accent for a film and a story with characters set in Italy? Oh, that was a bit odd.
I think that's okay. I recently rewatched The Gospel According to Matthew, Pasolini's masterpiece about, you know, life of Jesus. And that as well, it's all set, you know, on the locations, Jerusalem, stuff like that. But everyone in the film, Jesus, all the disciples, everyone in the film are speaking Italian, of course, because Pasolini's Italian and he made it with Italian non-actors. You know, they're all sort of plucked off the streets of Italy. But for me, it didn't bother me at all. You know, I kind of totally went with it, and it is an accepted masterpiece as it should be. So I know what you're saying, but I can kind of let that go. I think if Pasolini can do it, then Verhoeven can.
Fair enough. I have to say a word as well about Lambert Wilson in this film, who is quite extraordinary. He plays a character called Lenonce, which I don't know if that's a double entendre or not, but I assume it is, given it's Verhoeven, but it's an incredible name. He's just so bizarre and odd in this film. He plays a sort of superior to the nunnery. He's a sort of papal ambassador, and he's brought in as part of Benedetta's trial, to put her on trial for whether she's committed these acts of blasphemy or not. And he's just having the time of his life in this film, I think. Such a larger-than-life performance. After I was just utterly dismayed at whatever he was doing in The Matrix Resurrections, I was back on board the Lambert Wilson train after this film. I thought, yeah, he was an absolute treat in this film, I thought.
Yeah, but I wanted more of that. You know, I think that the whole film should have been that. It should have been that bit more sort of larger than life in a way. And for me, I mean, if you're talking great nunsploitation movies, because it is a whole subgenre of itself, you know, for me, you've got to say Ken Russell's The Devils, obviously, you know, I don't think this gets anywhere near that. And on a slightly more sort of, artistic, that's a bit snobby, but I'm thinking like Powell and Pressburger's Black Narcissus, which, you know, he goes much further in a way with all the nudity and stuff like that, but it just can't touch it. And while we're talking nunsploitation movies, a special shout out for The Killer Nun. If you've never seen that, then Anita Ekberg, made in the late 70s. She plays a nun who discovers drugs, murder, sex, goes completely off the rails. And yeah, that's great fun. So I suggest rather than watch Benedetta, you go and watch A Killer Nun instead.
All right, great. So it sounds like you're recommending Benedetta, Leila. And Jamie, you're a bit more on the fence. Would that be fair to say?
I'm on the fence. I think it's okay. It's a 3-star movie. I'm not sort of saying it's terrible, don't go and see it. But given it's Verhoeven and given his last movie was L, which is so interesting and such a strange and riveting film, I was disappointed by this on the whole. You know, with a Paul Verhoeven movie, I'm expecting 4 or 5 stars. So, yeah, a bit disappointed.
Right. So that's Benedetta, and that is out in cinemas on Friday. From nuns to politicians now, with this.
It meant nothing. It was just sex.
Nothing's just sex. There's more. You're not telling me just to tell me. To unburden yourself.
The story's about to break.
Sometimes I think I'm partly to blame. I let things slide.
Making this right is all I care about.
Right, so that's Anatomy of a Scandal, which hits Netflix on Friday. Leila, what's this one about?
This is based on a novel by Sarah Vaughan, and it's the Netflix series where a prominent conservative politician, and I did like that they specified that he was conservative because a lot of the times they won't say, and he's got a very supportive, beautiful wife, Sienna Miller, and an idyllic life and lots of gorgeous children and an incredible house. And he's caught having an affair with one of his young aides who then accuses him of raping her in a lift. So it kind of becomes this big public trial where he's being prosecuted by hotshot barrister played by Michelle Doherty. Yeah, so over the sort of 6 episodes, most of it is set kind of during over the course of the trial, but we're also seeing his wife and the barrister kind of go into their backstories, figure out their relationship with man, this man, decide whether they think he's innocent or guilty, and kind of where the boundaries of consent lie.
It's an interesting show because I watched the first 2 episodes and thought, ooh, this is interesting. Obviously feels quite topical, the idea of dealing with a political scandal. I mean, feels like it's permanently topical nowadays because there's always some political scandal going on, but particularly this week, not necessarily this scandal exactly. I really like Sienna Miller. I like the fact that this is a story that's told from the wife's perspective. It's not a story about this politician necessarily. It's definitely not a story about the victim, who we don't really see her perspective at all outside of the trial itself. It's very much how Sienna Miller's character deals with the trial and the fallout and the accusations and what the truth may or may not be. I thought that was all very interesting. But as the show went on, it suddenly dawned on me that this is actually like pure trash. Like, it's just a pure trash drama thriller, kind of masquerading as peak TV prestige drama. I don't want to give anything away, but there's a huge twist in the middle of it, which I just thought was absolute hokum, like just pure nonsense, just totally nonsensical, just made a farce of the rest of the show. I really, really disliked that the decisions that they made with that. It's directed by S.J. Clarkson, who previously directed, you know, things like Jessica Jones, has done some great work on TV. She has some interesting flourishes here, a lot of sort of intriguing transitions between sort of stories that they're telling. So you'll see the flashback and then it will transition into them telling that story in the courtroom in quite an interesting and stylish way. But she inserts these kind of weird moments where people's feelings are reflected in physical reactions. So like someone will be delivered bad news and they'll suddenly get blown back like they've been hit with a shotgun blast or something. And I just found that just just laughably silly. Like, it's just so like obvious and on the nose and just over directed to within an inch of its life. So I really wasn't keen on some of the choices they made there. And it just goes to places that I didn't think were particularly smart or interesting. Like, it ends on a very bizarre note, which just didn't work for me at all. And I thought the whole point of the show was just undercut by its final moments. I was really disappointed after initially being quite intrigued and excited by what they were setting up. I thought it could go to some really interesting and strong places, but I left just feeling a bit nonplussed and kind of disappointed that I'd invested 6 hours of my life into it.
No, I'm with you, utter hokum. It's one of the most kind of like heavy-handedly written things I've seen in a very, very long time, where a character will just turn to another one and be like, did you know that men could rape their wives until 1991? And I'm just like, well, they're both barristers, so they probably do know this. Or like at one point, Sienna Miller says something about maybe we haven't earned everything we have in our lives, and the privilege to which we were born into is actually some of the reason for our good fortune. It's just like, yeah, no shit, Sherlock. I mean, hashtag me too response, which, I mean, not to give away this plot, but that is also kind of the twist. It's just, I didn't enjoy it at all, to be honest, because from like the minute one, I just felt the edits were so heavy-handed. It felt a bit like that viral scene from Bohemian Rhapsody that went around for ages, where just kind of, it's so choppy. But yeah, over-directed, I think is the exact word.
So I've never read the book, so I can't speak to whether this story works better on the page or not, but David E. Kelly is a co-writer on this, of course, who has done things like Big Little Lies, kind of real like impressive prestige TV stuff. But I just felt like something's gone wrong behind the scenes here, where it's all just become a bit of a mess, to be honest. It felt like they knew how sensitive the subject matter they were dealing with was, and it felt like there were just too many voices trying to navigate it. And what has ended up happening is that it's just become way too heavy-handed and blunt, whereas it could have been, you know, quite subtle and powerful. There are some really like impressive scenes, especially in the trial. Naomi Scott, who of course played Princess Jasmine in the Aladdin remake, she plays the victim of this accused rape. And her kind of testimony on the stand, I thought, was really moving and really powerful. She gives an incredible performance in what is a very sort of limited role, in the sense that she's basically stuck on a stand in a trial, and she doesn't really have a life outside of that. So she has to deliver this basically monologue. And I found that all just, it was really well written, really well performed. But the plot sort of machinations outside of those impressive individual moments just didn't work for me at all. It's a real shame, because I thought that there's something here, but the execution leaves a lot to be desired, I think.
And you know when you can feel a show is just kind of like biding time until a plot is coming up.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. Jamie, you haven't seen this one. Are you intrigued? Do you think you'll check it out?
Not after that, Jordan, no. I was intrigued. I like Sienna Miller. Mm-hmm. And like you say, it's kind of, it's being sold as prestige TV and one of the new big things. So I was quite looking forward to it, but you two guys have kind of dampened that somewhat. But I'll probably give it a go, see how I get on with it.
Yeah, maybe if you go in with slightly lower expectations than what myself and Layla did, maybe you'll enjoy it more. But yeah, I was utterly a bit disappointed in the final results here.
Not right. In the era of prestige TV. We're in the golden age of television. All the shows that we named at the beginning, this isn't good enough.
Yeah, it's just not up to those standards, really, is it? So that's Anatomy of Scandal, and it starts on Netflix this Friday. That's almost all for this week's episode. But before we go, there's time for another listener's question. And this week it is, what movie should I watch in hospital, set in a hospital? So I think this person is currently in a hospital and wants recommendations for films set in hospitals to watch while they are there, which seems quite perverse if you ask me, but each to their own. Jamie, what are you picking?
Oh, that does seem perverse to me, because most films set in hospitals aren't particularly cheerful. Quite a lot of horror movies set in hospitals, obviously. I would say I'm just going to go for a shout out for the William Peter Blatty 1980 film, The Ninth Configuration, kind of more of an asylum type thing. But I think it's underrated that because, you know, it came after The Exorcist and he obviously wrote The Exorcist, expectations were sky high and people were disappointed. But I think it's a film that deserves to be kind of rediscovered in a way that it's an interesting, strange, bizarre little film. So I think that would keep keep the person who's asked the question like entertained, definitely. And another shout out, even though I don't particularly like it, but it just occurs to me, Halloween 2 is obviously all set in a hospital or a loss of it. Again, if you just want a sort of bit of mindless entertainment slasher film, then I'd go with that. And I think those choices may be more than something which is really serious. So maybe go for something a bit more entertaining.
I thought you were going to recommend The Exorcist 3 when you mentioned William Peter Blatty, Jamie, who of course staged one of the sort of all-time great jump scares in a hospital.
So good. So good.
It's, yeah, the one with the shears, the big scissors kind of thing coming out. Yeah, it is. I mean, The Exorcist 3 is okay, but no, that one didn't occur to me at the time, so I'll stick with my original two.
All right, Layla, what are you going with?
I've got one for depending how serious the trip to the hospital is. So I think if it's just kind of like maybe you having like you've got a broken leg or something, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, one of my favorite films, fantastic performances, love that movie very much. Probably top three favorite films ever for me is Ikiru, which is not entirely set in a hospital, but has scenes in a hospital. And I would say if you're in the hospital for very, very serious reasons, Ikiru is like the perfect film for that.
Yeah, I mean, we really could have done with a few more details about why this listener is in hospital, but hey-ho, we got to work with what we got to work with. I'm going to go for Hard Boiled, John Woo's action classic, of course, where Chow Yun-Fat shoots his way through hospital with a baby cradled under his arm. Just an absolute belter of a scene. One of the all-time great action movies, one of the all-time great action set pieces. Rightly iconic. I think no matter what you're in for, you're going to enjoy Hard Boiled. I think unless you're in for a gunshot wound, then maybe you'll get some kind of trauma from that.
I've got to say, though, if Layla is having Ikiru just because it's got some scenes set in hospital, I mean, changing the boundaries there a bit. In that case, I'm going to go for Godfather, just because, like, Marlon Brando's character is in hospital for a little bit, isn't he? He's, like, in hospital and meant to be being staked out, and then, obviously, you know, another attack comes in hospital. So even though out of the whole 3.5 hours or whatever, the Godfather, probably about 10 minutes is set in a hospital.
All right, this is too much rule bending now. I'm gonna have to bring this to a close. Okay, so that's all we have time for this week, unfortunately. Just a reminder that the new issue of Total Film is out now and has Mr. Tom Cruise on the cover, the star of Top Gun Maverick, the long-awaited sequel to Top Gun. I know Jamie's particularly excited about this one.
Oh, don't even get me started, mate. I've been waiting 35 years for this film. I saw Top Gun when I was like 14, and I'm going to have to say it really did take my breath away. absolutely adored it and watched it on loop as a teenage boy. So, yeah, I'm a big Tom Cruise fan and I think he's going to nail this. I've heard rumours. I've heard little bits of buzz of people in the industry who have seen it. And yes, the news is that it's very good news, apparently.
Well, that sounds very exciting. And if you want to learn more about Top Gun Maverick, of course, pick up our new issue where Matt Maiden spoke to the Cruiser himself, director Joseph Kosinski, the producer Jerry Bruckheimer, Miles Teller, so many people, well worth reading. Right, with that, all that's left to do is say goodbye. Say goodbye, Jamie.
Goodbye, Jamie.
Say goodbye, Layla.
Bye.
Bye. We'll be back next week. Well, Jane will be back, which you'll all be very glad to hear, I'm sure. Bye.